You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 11th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Evan!
Kara is still away this week, but she will be back next week.
I noticed Jay's back.
And Jay's back, yep.
I'm back. Guys, I'm so busy with my day job, you have no idea.
Well, we have a little bit of an idea. We didn't see you last week.
That's right. But I did have time. Bob and I actually had time this weekend to go on a, we went on like a couple's wine van cruise type of thing. We rented a 10-passenger van. We drove around local Connecticut wineries, and we had a great time.
Yeah, except for the wine. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Wine's not your thing, Bob, is it?
Yeah.
It was more about the company, you know, and we brought
it. It certainly was.
But man, so one of the wineries we went to had some pseudoscience, and it was interesting.
Just one?
This was the one of the ones we went to, we were getting a hard pitch the whole time, and it was revolving around all the pseudoscience. One, he started talking to us about antioxidants and how, you know, his wine actually is healthy for you to drink. On some level, the antioxidants will help you not age as much as you're aging right now.
Yeah.
That's what was communicated. So, and then he was getting into organic farming and that they're right now they're testing organic farming, and he's talking about the chemicals. And then someone else that was not with us that was there sampling wine said, oh, does the organic farming that you're doing, is the yield bigger? And he turns to the guy, and I thought they were going to get into like a conversation about how everything about organic is better, but he turns to the guy and goes, no. Just like that. Like, okay. And you know, and I'm starting to review facts in my head, you know, like asking him, well, you know, can you tell me about the chemicals, you know, and why are they considered organic? You know, what chemicals are you using on the non-organic? What's the difference? You know, I wanted to kind of like to start asking questions to get the guy, you know, rolling out some facts so that I could use those facts later in the conversation. Then I'm like, nope, I'm not doing any of this. I'm not here to be a skeptic. I'm here to, you know, test wine. So then he was also talking about how he produces a wine that is sulfite free. He was saying that sulfite's essentially something that everybody doesn't want in the wine, but it's in most wine that's produced. And if you do a little research on sulfites, you'll find that there's no real evidence that it causes headaches. Complaints that you'll typically hear is that people get headaches if they drink wine that has sulfites in it. And, you know, it's a preservative. And if it's not in wine, the wine's flavor can dramatically change, and how long the wine will last will dramatically change. I'm not reading anything about sulfites that bothers me or that worries me. I mean, I originally thought that they caused headaches until I did some reading, but that was all part of his shtick.
It's all the clean eating bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, that's, which is, you know, I would expect that to be rampant in anything like that, you know?
I thought that was a little fun thing that was happening, because everybody immediately, when the guy started talking this way, they were looking at me and Bob, like expecting us to be like, no, you're wrong, sir. You know, it's like, yeah, I'm not doing that. it's not why I'm here today.
You're off duty.
Jay and Bob, did any of these places try selling you or have on display a device for sale which supposedly makes a inexpensive bottle of wine taste like some super expensive bottle of wine?
No.
Yeah, it's called a fake label.
Yeah, I don't think.
Yeah, right.
Seriously, you put an expensive label on wine, people will think it tastes like an expensive wine.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's definitely true. There's so much psychology involved in that. One thing that one of the what do you call these wine guys?
Wine guy?
What do you call them?
Winers.
Winos. One of the winos told us, that paints a different picture. One of the people that produce wine was saying was that you can, if you take a red wine and you swirl it around in the glass. Remember this, mm-hmm. Bob? Gave us a demonstration.
Yeah.
If it's an aged wine, it will not stick to the side of the glass. Only a non-aged wine will do that. And, you know, you can see this if you have the right kind of wine. If you switch it around, the red color will kind of stick to the inside of the glass a little bit, and it has like a pinky, misty look to it.
So therefore, some property breaks down over time.
Yeah, there's something in the chemistry of the bottle being, you know, something is happening when wine is aged that it won't do that anymore. And then he was saying how he was at a restaurant and they had on the menu, you know, aged wine or whatever, and it was really expensive. And he did that test with the wine and it was clearly like, you know, fresh wine. You know, it was like something that was probably produced within the last year.
Uh-huh.
And he told the waiter and he ended up getting kicked out of the restaurant. Which I'm like, wow, that happens? Like, the wine snobbery is pretty epic.
So who was kicked out of the restaurant? He lost.
He was for pointing out that they were falsely advertising aged wine. When
he is the customer.
They kicked the customer out for calling him on their false advertising.
Yes.
Exactly. Bad for business, you see.
Yeah. Oh, boy. No. Yeah, that's where rough. I thought that story was going.
Yeah, I know. When he told me the story, I didn't think it was going there either, but he did give the cool demonstration, and we were looking at it like, oh, yeah, you're right. It doesn't stick to the side.
Here's your lobster, sir. No, I'm sorry. This is trout. Get out.
Did you ask him if he could tell the difference between red and white wine blindfolded?
Do you really think you can't? Steve, do you really think you can't?
That there was a study which showed that if you know you put red dye in white wine, people think it's red wine.
Oh, my God. The whole thing is so funny because it's like basically propped up on what? Like, really? I can tell the difference in taste between an aged wine and a non-aged wine. Aged wine, you can. I think a lot of times you can tell there's a definite thing that you taste in a non-aged wine. It just has a flavor to it. And I would love to test that to see how, you know, wrong my perception is.
Well, we'll add that to our wine and our tea and coffee tasting that we have to do at some point.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
If you're all that blind to stuff on ourselves. But the thing is, the real point is that there is so much, you know, there's visual information too. When we eat something, the experience of eating, it's not just taste. It's also the texture, the mouthfeel, the smell, and also visually what it looks like, and expectation.
Yep.
Our senses actually change based upon those other senses. So it's obviously smell and taste is very closely related, but even just the way it looks, the way the food looks will affect. So that is why a lot of food producers will very deliberately manipulate the color or the look of the food. If you have something that's supposed to be lime flavored, even if it would be normally colorless, they will put green dye in there so it looks like lime.
Sure.
Like orange soda is not orange. You know, it's clear. They make it right. Orange colored so that you have that visual stimuli so you know it's orange, you know?
Yeah.
So you're sort of tricking your brain into thinking, okay, I'm really having something that is orange.
Have you guys ever had colorless soda?
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's horrible.
Yeah, it's just not right. You know what I mean?
Right, it's just visually wrong. It hurts.
It's funny.
Have you guys ever had salmon?
Yes.
I don't eat salmon.
Did you know that salmon is not actually naturally orange colored? No, but the flesh, of the fish is not actually
salmon colored.
Yeah, it's not salmon colored.
Gray?
Yeah, it's like a gray white, and they it's affected by the food that they feed the fish.
I see. Yeah, that's true of a lot of seafood. That the color is from what they eat. Like flamingos are not pink unless they eat
the shells or
crustaceans.
Right?
That give them the pink color. Yeah.
That elephant I saw in the room after the wine tour was pink.
All right, let's get started. Bob, you're going to get us going with a forgotten superhero of science.
Yes. So for this week's forgotten superheroes of science, I'm covering Francis Glessner Lee, 1878 to 1962, who is known as the mother of forensic science. Glessner was fascinated with forensic science, law, and medicine, but women didn't go to college at her time, so she had to resign herself to being a housewife while she watched her brother go to Harvard. And she had an unhappy marriage. She eventually got divorced, and she always kind of regretted not having the opportunities that men had. When her father, who was a wealthy industrialist, died, he left her a boatload of money. And so in her 50s, Glessner embarked on a new career, the one that she always wanted. her middle name's Glessner, her last name is Lee. So she endowed the Harvard Department of Legal Medicine in 1931, the first of its kind in the United States. Working with Dr. George Burgess McGrath, Boston's medical examiner, they both changed the way detectives approached crime scenes, fundamentally changed it. Forensic investigation was finally becoming a scientific enterprise. It was really dramatic. And she did this in a large part through the creation of these exquisite dioramas of crime scenes. They were incredible. She would create a crime scene diorama with amazing detail. You know, there were tiny working doors. The lights worked. Even the little tiny mouse traps actually worked. She would create these little tiny newspaper replicas. And ironically, she used a lot of the skills that she had acquired when she was a housewife in terms of maybe, you know, painting and embroidering and things like that. But she had an eye for detail. She called her little multi-$1,000 scenes. I mean, we're talking $3,000 and $4,000, and this is going back, you know, many, many decades. So it's even more amazing than you would even think. She called them nutshells because she said they can be used to convict the guilty, clear the innocent, and find the truth in a nutshell. She said it's truly about using your powers of observation to guess and to try and see what was happening in the scene. So she would display this beautiful diorama for these detectives, and they had to look at everything. Everything was there that they needed, or any detail, blood spatter, murder weapon, everything was there, and they had to kind of just figure the whole thing out. And apparently, from what I'm reading, scenes like this are still used today to train homicide investigators. So remember Frances Glessner Lee. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing galvanoplastics, Louis Daguerre, or perhaps forensic dactyloscopy.
What was that last one? Dactyloscopy?
Forensic dactyloscopy. Fingerprints. Dactyl?
Oh, dactyl. Okay, yeah.
Yes.
Cool. So it is interesting, you know, when you think about how many things went through that transition from a pre-scientific to a scientific era, right? And that was what a profound transition that was. Medicine itself, you know, went from that transition from pre-scientific to scientific.
I mean, but talk about changing the world.
Yeah. But for forensic science, yeah, I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but you know, a lot of forensic science is bullshit. And there's core ones that are legitimate,
but
a lot of pseudoscience is kind of infiltrated, I think, because of the pressure to have like bring scientific evidence to bear in court cases. And then there was a proliferation of, you know, pseudo experts.
Mm-hmm. Like bite analysis.
So they really, like bite analysis. So they
identikits and these sorts
or
of
hair
things.
Analysis or even like the bullet analysis. There's things that are based on a lot on subjective pattern recognition, which really hasn't been validated. Fingerprints are valid. I mean, those are, although you could overcall them as well, but you know, at the core of, you know, fingerprint analysis is legitimate. So I think we need to go through another period of like really purging the borderline or pseudoscience from, you know, what is getting admitted, you know, as forensic science in courtroom. And people talk about the CSI effect. You guys, we've used that term before where jurors expect like to be wowed with scientific evidence when they're on a jury on a murder case. And it creates an unrealistic expectation. And then they get disappointed. I think, well, there isn't any of this, you know, CSI type evidence. So maybe they don't know what's going on.
Right. See a shadow of doubt.
Yeah. So there was a interesting news item. It was a review of the literature looking at the effects of debunking myths, which is something that we're interested in here on the SU because we do it a lot, right? And we want to know the science of what it is we're actually doing. So what do you think was the bottom line here? Does debunking work or not work?
Oh, work on – meaning work on the people that are
you're
believing.
Yeah, trying
it, right?
to change the belief in – myths and belief in facts that are wrong by correcting them.
Yeah. And probably more people dig their heels in rather than change their mind.
I would think it works.
I think the answer was it depends.
Yeah, the answer is it depends. It works sort of sometimes if you do it right, but it's not easy. That's the answer.
Yeah. Oh, good. That's nice, simple answer.
The psychologist reviewed the literature on this specific question, and what they found is that if you just say, no, that belief is wrong, that has no effect, basically, no significant effect.
All right.
What you have to do is give people a replacement explanatory system, right? You have to give them an alternate narrative. So in other words, you need to tell them why it's wrong, why people believe this wrong thing, and what's true and why it's true. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. So you need what they call a detailed debunking message that includes an explanatory narrative, not just a factual correction.
Okay.
Yeah. Which I think is what we do, right? So I think that that intuitively makes sense to me. It kind of fits with our experience. So first of all, we know it's not easy. We know it's not as simple as just telling somebody that they're wrong or giving them factual information. And, you know, what we basically do is we, you know, have in-depth nitty-gritty discussions about exactly why people believe wrong things. How does that belief come about? How does it propagate? How does it propagate? What, you know, again, why it's wrong? And then what is true? How we know what's true? And, you know, all the supporting facts and logic and critical thinking skills and psychology that goes with it. And I guess what this literature is saying is that, yeah, you pretty much need to do that. You know, you need to really, you need to have this deep, what they call the detailed debunking message, not just fixing factual information. The digging in your heels effect, Evan, I think is part of all this, but it's separate. That's when you have an emotional investment in the belief as a ideology or source of identity. Mm-hmm. If you have a vested interest in the belief, like if you're developing your political tribe, if you're defending your political tribe, for example, or defending your religious belief, mm-hmm. or defending something that you have internalized as an identity, then you will absolutely dig in your heels, which means that when faced with correcting information or debunking information, that motivates you to search for justifications to justify your belief and to reject the correcting information. And that actually strengthens your belief in the original position. But if that's only when you have a vested interest. If you don't, then people will generally accept the corrections. Because people do want to be correct. There is a correction bias. We want to be correct. But what this is saying is slightly tangential to that. It's like, even if they don't have a vested interest in it, they may not change just by giving them the correct information, because the old information may have already been incorporated into a narrative. Even if it's not an identity or a tribe or an ideology, it's still, you know, if somebody has a nice story that explains something, It's a lot of mental work to change the narrative, to change the story. So you have to kind of give it to them. All right. So let's take, for example, a conspiracy theory. Someone believes 9/11 was an inside job.
Yep.
That's part of a narrative. Now we know if they believe it was an inside job because they're on the ideological left and they hate Bush, that, and it's part of their sort of tribal narrative against the enemy, somebody on the other side, you know, then yeah, it's nothing's going to matter, right? They're going to dig in their heels. But even if they're, or if they're a dedicated conspiracy theorist, where conspiracy theories are part of their worldview and their identity, yeah, you're probably not going to change their mind either. But I think there are a lot of people who just, for them, it was just a prepackaged narrative. You know, it's like, it kind of makes sense of everything. And, right? It's like, oh, you know, how did this happen? You know, there are all these weird things, you know, and here's this narrative which sort of explains it all. Just telling them, no, it wasn't an inside job. That's, you know, that's a conspiracy theory. That's incorrect. You know, here's the official story may not be enough to change their mind. You need to tell them, this is how conspiracy thinking works. And this is why these beliefs emerge. And here's how we know what actually did happen. You know what I mean? You have to give them a replacement narrative, which in my opinion, the replacement narrative that we offer is the skeptical narrative, right? It's
sure.
Belief in critical thinking, self-knowledge, scientific methodology leads to an understanding of how reliable specific claims are. And that I think that's a powerful narrative. We as we've mentioned before, we occasionally get emails from people who listen to our show as a non-skeptic to hear what the quote-unquote other side has to say, or, you know, maybe because they were interested in some of the things that we had to say, but not others. And over time, again, you know, after weeks and months of getting repeated detailed debunking messages, they started to adopt the skeptical narrative. You know, they became skeptics. So anyway, I think that, you know, it's interesting when the scientific research dovetails so much with our personal experience, you know. I mean, I think that's exactly when you should be especially skeptical of the science, when it's confirming what you think you've already believed. But
right.
It doesn't mean it's not true. It just means that we need to be careful. We don't accept it too easily. But in any case, I think, you know, to me, this says, okay, the evidence we do have, you know, according to this review, supports continuing to do what we're doing, which is to like really get into a lot of detail in order to counteract myths and false beliefs that are out there in the public. You can't just do a 30-second public service announcement. That's not going to do it.
And we've had that speech won't work.
Yeah, we had that conversation before. Like a lot of research shows that the PSAs don't work. If you do this, if you do that, it's like I think the problem is not the strategy. It's that PSAs don't work. It's too short. You need to give a fully fleshed out narrative and detailed explanations before people are going to buy it.
Which might be a little counterintuitive in that we are of the YouTube sort of generation now, in which we want, generally speaking, people want to consume things faster, easier, quicker, whether it's their entertainment, no matter what it is. So it sort of goes against that grain in a certain sense.
Yeah, so this is what I think about that. I think you're correct. But as we've also discussed previously on the show, when we were talking to Craig Good about cinema, I think it applies. I think that, you know, as we have become more media savvy, more savvy at consuming various types of multimedia, that we have collectively, the producers and the consumers of media, have learned a language which enables us to communicate in a very efficient way. And so you may watch that 3-minute YouTube video, and that 3 minutes may be enough to communicate a detailed narrative that is prepackaged. I do think that's where we are at a disadvantage, because often the skeptical narrative is a lot more complicated and takes a lot more time, you know, to get people there.
That's the challenge.
Yeah.
That's the part of what we do that makes it so difficult. That's exactly why I didn't even want to go there with the wine guy.
Yeah, because like, where do you start? It's like, okay, you can't give him a. You could have thrown out your almost like trolling kind of comment, but unless you really had like the ability to have a 20 or 30 minute conversation, it's probably not worth it. Unless you just feel like they just need to know. Not everybody agrees with that, you know. Sometimes I throw that out there. I say, well, just for the record, I don't think that that's true. You know, if you ever want to get a detailed conversation about it, we can have that another time. But just so that they know. Not this is not generally accepted.
Yeah, I mean that's a nice public service announcement, but no, I don't agree, Bob. I don't think it's enough for most people, especially, you know, this guy was dyed in the wool, right? I mean, he was selling his wine through these things. He was using them as a vehicle to make his wine special. So it would have been a big conversation.
Yeah, Jay, my point was not that that would have necessarily applied to him, but for some people, just knowing that there is some dissension is shocking enough, you know, and surprising enough that for them, they may start looking into it like, oh, wow, I didn't even know that was on the, you know, that was even possible, really. So, yeah, so for some people, that could be enough. But, yeah, for this guy, it wouldn't for sure.
The other time I do it, even if I don't have time to get into detail, is when I think that there's a consumer feedback angle. So if this guy's doing this because he thinks this is what consumers want, it might be enough to say, here's a consumer who doesn't want the pseudoscience with their wine or whatever it is that they're selling. You know, that kind of feedback is important. That's why I say, like, if you are seeing a doctor and the doctor tries to push acupuncture or whatever on you, it's important to tell them, you know what? I don't like that. I don't think that's scientific. It gives me concerns about your approach and I don't feel comfortable with this. Rather than just never giving them the feedback and going away, then they don't know that there's people out there who don't want the bullshit, you know? So it's always a delicate balance. You have to know your audience, know the context, and be at least thoughtful about what you're doing. But sometimes the knee-jerk skepticism is counterproductive or just inappropriate and doesn't really accomplish anything. You don't have to feel obligated to always be an ass or to, you know, again, in some contexts, just like lobbing in skeptical, you know, observations is kind of trolling. You have to know when it's going to be useful, constructive, appropriate. But, you know, sometimes the quickie feedback can be effective, but you have to be thoughtful about how you do it.
Yeah, it's hard because on the spectrum of becoming a skeptic, an educated skeptic, you know, I had this journey. Steve, I think you were very good at avoiding a lot of the initial drama that I was attracted to it. I liked being confrontational and having knowledge and, you know, being able to tell people that they were wrong and say stupid and provocative things that, if anything, I just probably made a lot of people upset for probably 5 years or so as I was becoming a skeptic initially.
Longer than that, Jay.
Probably, right? But Evan, you know, did you go through that? Did you have like a period where you were like almost a naysayer? Yeah. Like, no, that's bullshit.
It's because when you first discover, I think, sort of a skeptical approach, you're very excited to sort of share it with as many people as possible. And it can become sort of an overzealous thing in which you're trying to sell it too hard in a certain sense. And you know, a soft sell at certain points is a better approach in certain circumstances.
You mature. Your approach matures as you get more experience and you talk with more people and you take a more and more thoughtful approach. It evolves. You know, that's fine. We've certainly worked with a lot of people over the years who were, you know, in that initial enthusiastic phase where they wanted to change the world and they wanted to have every battle, no matter how tiny and, you know, and to be an activist in creative ways, like, you know, go in the bookstore and put the pseudoscience books behind the other books or whatever. Just do crazy stuff. It's like, yeah, you know, just calm down. Is that you're not going to change the world and you don't have to be constantly in battle mode. It's not just picking your battles, but it's also understanding the situation, the context, the people that you're dealing with, and that there's a backfire effect, right? You want to avoid any backfire effect. Sometimes it's better to do nothing than to do something half-cocked and thoughtlessly. That's just not going to achieve the goal that you want to achieve. Meaning well isn't enough. You have to be thoughtful about if you're an activist, you have to be thoughtful about how you're being an activist, about what you're doing. You want an actual effect, not just the satisfaction of saying, well, I did something, you know. But it is really, really tricky. And I think what we're trying to do is especially tricky because we're often trying to replace simplistic, appealing narratives with complicated, maybe not so appealing narratives, or what's appealing about them is a lot deeper and more subtle and more, maybe more remote. It's like, well, you're not going to live forever in a paradise. You are going to just die and be food for worms, but you're going to have a much more clear-eyed view of reality. You know, it's not always an easy sell.
No,
not to beat that dead horse because we've talked about this a lot as well. But anyway, this is what we do. We have to be introspective as well. All right, Jay. So we're going to go from this topic about debunking to debunking a bit of pseudoscience that I've been annoyed at for a while, but tell us about mindfulness meditation. Is this legit or not?
That's a great question, Steve. You must quietly ask yourself first, have you heard of mindfulness? Are you self-aware of mindfulness? Sorry, did I start to hypnotize you by accident? You know, mindfulness, I've heard of it. I've had close friends of mine recommend that I practice it to improve my sleep. And it is interesting. And let's talk about what it is, and then we'll get into some research that's been done recently, and we'll see what you guys think at the end. Mm-hmm. So mindfulness is the practice of focusing your full attention on, as an example, the current moment, the thing that's happening to you right now, at that specific moment. You could be, you know, having a meal. You could just be observing your surroundings. You could be spending time with a pet, whatever. The point is to not have your mind wander to the past or the future, but exist in your now, in that moment. And people develop mindfulness as a skill by using meditation as an example. Like if you meditate, that could help you kind of focus yourself in a sense, and you could become more aware of your surroundings and listen to all your sensory input, everything that's coming in, that type of thing. Mindfulness is a significant part of the Buddhist tradition. And it was popularized in the 1970s by a Massachusetts professor named Jon Kabat-Zinn. And he is a cognitive scientist who used mindfulness to help with stress reduction. And he is directly responsible for why we are all talking about it today, why we all know about it. There are many claims about the benefits of mindfulness, but the most common one cited is that it helps develop a sense of well-being. And since this is extraordinarily subjective, this sense of well-being, there's no real way to measure that other than just talking to people and asking them how they feel. Other studies, though, have concluded that practitioners have improved cognitive function, and that is somewhat testable, and even make claims that the tips of chromosomes, you know, the telomeres that we've talked about, that you could affect, you know, how well your telomeres perform, or the, you know, the fact that they're still there and intact and doing what they're doing.
Through which is mindfulness?
Yeah, well, that's some of the crazier claims that are out there. I'm just giving you a spectrum here of things that people say. So what's the reality behind it? And what can we legitimately do with the claims that are being made? You know, are they fantasy? You know, can we quantify them? Well, neuroscientists and psychologists and even people who are practiced at meditation are saying that some of the claims are not backed by science, which I think is, you know, very typical of something that's, you know, quote unquote new, at least new to most of us. You know, most of us don't have detailed understanding of what it is. In a recent article published in Perspectives on Psychological Science, scientists and psychologists raise concerns, saying that the existing scientific data on mindfulness is weak. They cite problems with the studies that currently exist. And you probably have heard us say this on the show before, but the studies, a lot of them are poorly designed, and they often don't have a control group, which rules out the placebo effect. And that's a, you know, super fast and obvious thing that a lot of these studies don't have. And also it was noted that the studies are not even using a consistent definition of what mindfulness is. And that's really a big problem, because if the researchers don't agree on exactly what it is they're researching, then they can't compare their data. And that makes it so you can't do meta-analyses and try to, you know, find some answers in all of that information. Now, they found that 9% of the clinical trials on mindfulness included a controlled group, only 9%, which, again, that's not good. They also say in the paper that the studies that did have a control group produced unimpressive results. So a 2014 review of 47 meditation trials, collectively including over 3,500 participants, found no evidence for benefits related to enhancing attention, curtailing substance abuse, aiding sleep, or controlling weight. Nicholas Van Dam, the lead author in the report, he's a clinical psychologist and a research fellow in psychological sciences at the University of Melbourne, and he believes that any of the potential benefits that mindfulness could actually have are being obscured by all the hype and bullshit, using my word. This is, of course, coming mostly from those who stand to make money off of it. So, you know, I find it absolutely amazing that mindfulness as an idea has become a $1.1 billion industry in the U.S. alone. $1.1 billion a year people are spending on this idea of mindfulness, learning about it, taking classes, buying books, you know, paying for online videos and tutorials and seminars and all this stuff. And Van Dam noted that there may be some positive effects from it. You know, if you practice mindfulness, there might be some things about it that you could get out of it, but only rigorous scientific studies are going to be able to prove that these things are valuable or not. Now, here are some things that are true. The 2014 analysis found meditation and mindfulness may provide modest benefits in anxiety, depression, and pain. And Van Dam later noted, he said, look, these are three things that we think it could potentially have a positive impact on, but without doing rigorous studies on these things that have already kind of been tested out that we find valuable enough to study, unless the time and attention and the correct type of studies are put in play to test those out, we'll never know.
But what immediately struck me by that, though, was they were saying, yeah, it may work for these three things that are really squirrely, that have a huge placebo effect, and that are the hardest to really do study rigorously, that are totally subjective. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, I wonder why those three things, you know, because so
they're all subjective. You're totally right, Steve. But still, I mean, they're, you know, doing the tests, doing studies on what something like mindfulness can do for people overall is good, but they're advising do properly formatted studies, properly constructed studies. Make sure that you're studying the negative effects as well. You shouldn't just be testing things that potentially could be positive, but are there any things that are problematic about it that could worsen a person's condition? They were saying that, as an example, that some studies have shown that it reduces self-perceived stress, but not the hormone cortisol. Right. So there you go. Like that's a great thing to test, because you could say, hey, look, OK, people are saying that they're feeling less stress, but biologically we're not seeing the proof of that. Mm-hmm. And you know, they can then draw some information out of studies that are looking at that as an example.
My big problem with the research, though, so yeah, they're not doing well controlled studies, but the problem is you have something with a vague definition, right? There really isn't an operational definition of what it is. They go, well, it's a different thing for every person. Okay, whatever. But they don't really control for any specific variable, so you can't really study it scientifically. So in other words, I always look to see, like, whenever, like, every week there are studies where mindfulness works for this or for that. It's all tooth fairy science, right? It's all, you know, doing superficial science and not really addressing the actual underlying question of, is there something real here that actually has an effect that you could measure? And so what they don't do is have as a control group something that would control for all of the non-specific effects of relaxation, but not whatever you think defines mindfulness. So that's the thing. That's why you need to be able to have an operational definition of mindfulness. And if you don't, then you can't control for it and you can't study it. So, like, for example, they say, well, mindfulness will lower your blood pressure. Yeah, I wonder if sitting and reading a book will lower your blood pressure.
Exactly.
Huh.
Right.
They should compare to that. They never compare to something like that, that I think would probably have the same effect. So there's so many analogies you can draw to this, like yoga, for example. Yoga is fine. Yoga is a type of exercise and stretching. But if you say, like, yoga works for X, it's like, okay, is it yoga specifically that works for X, or is it any kind of equivalent exercise and stretching that works? You know, is it really just that, did you control for physical activity? You know, or so if you're saying that yoga is a reasonable physical activity or reasonable form of exercise, that's fine.
Sure.
But if you go beyond that to say that there's something magical about it, it centers your chi and does that, you know, if you try to use those studies, which show that it has the same effects that any exercise has, in order to endorse specific claims that were not specifically controlled for, like it centers your chi, that's where the pseudoscience is. So, like, when they say, well, there's something about mindfulness that lengthens your telomeres. Bullshit. It's not lengthening your freaking telomeres, right? That's not happening. You know, but that's what they're trying to say. They're trying to use the non-specific effects of just sitting and relaxing or just taking a break from your day and then parlaying that into specific claims as if there's something magical happening. And it's much worse with transcendental meditation than mindfulness, which is a similar but distinct, you know, thing that is studied. And there's a lot of religious belief, you know, behind transcendental meditation. So there's a lot of motivation to overhype it. But this is the same phenomenon as with, for example, acupuncture, right? And so what, there are different phases of scientific research. There's sort of the preliminary phase where people are looking, they're doing small studies that may be controlled or not controlled, that are just trying to get an idea of, like, is there anything interesting happening here? How do we study it? You know, is it worth doing bigger studies? We don't really know if there's anything real going on until you figure out a way to isolate variables and test that in a rigorous, double-blind, placebo-controlled way. And then we figure out if it works or doesn't work. But what we're seeing happen a lot is either people never do those studies. They just stay in the preliminary study, or they go past the efficacy trials to pragmatic studies where they're just looking at how it's used, but they're not really testing to see, is it real or does it work? That's the tooth fairy part. Like, they're not really ever questioning the fundamental premise. Does the tooth fairy exist? They're just testing to see how much money is left for the teeth. You know, this is Harriet Hall's analogy, which I like. So it's the same thing. They stopped, or they do the studies, like they studied acupuncture. It doesn't work. So they go, well, never mind those studies. Let's just now start doing pragmatic studies, which are guaranteed to be positive, where we're not really asking the question. They're not efficacy trials. You're not isolating variables and seeing if those variables work. You're just saying, do people subjectively say they feel better when they get it, or
that's crazy.
Whatever.
That means it just becomes a marketing scheme.
Exactly.
That you can point to.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it just becomes a self-promoting belief system that has a life of its own, completely separate from science, but wants the imprimatur of science, but in the process is,
you're not gonna
utterly
get it.
It's destroying the fundamental pillars of science. that's like why like things like acupuncture drive me crazy, because it's really an attack on science itself.
Short
it's
drive.
An attack on the scientific basis of medicine. It turns scientific research on its head, and they literally do this. Proponents of acupuncture say, no, science works this way I want it to work, not the way you say it works. You know, we don't have to do efficacy trials, and we can't control for variables, and everyone's different. And it's all just bullshit reasons to explain away why they can't prove that their belief system is based in actual reality. And so while mindfulness may be a benign version of this, it's still crappy science or non-science pretending to be science by not doing it correctly. And it really is eroding the fundamental scientific basis of medicine. Mm-hmm. Not that I have any strong opinions about it.
Or have thought about it at all.
Yeah, so the thing that troubles me again is that there isn't a true way to test it, where, and then it's all then, like you were saying, Steve, like you might as well just sit there, close your eyes, take some deep breaths, have time to relax. Definitely watch Alpha Quadrant 6 as an example.
Yeah.
If you love Star Trek and
Jay, we should do the same kind of studies looking at the effects of watching Alpha Quadrant 6. I bet you it lowers your blood pressure and lengthens your telomeres just as much as mindfulness.
And in case you didn't know, that is our Star Trek Discovery after show that's live on Facebook. Oh my God, I am such a nerd. But it bothers me, Steve. It bothers me because so many people, like this example with mindfulness, I wanted it to be true because I would love to have something like this, you know, something that can relax you, that you can get good at.
Yeah.
That, you know, like
it's relax. And if it helps you relax, fine. Just say, hey, this is a technique that helps you relax.
Yeah.
But that's it. Just don't make any overhyped claims beyond that. You know, just sure, relaxation is proven to be good for you in lots of ways. You know, you don't want to be stressed all the time. It's good to take a break. And
but for $800, Steve, you can go to a 4-hour seminar, right? At the
But the people want the people want the magic, though. They want this. It's, uh-huh. It's not just a basic life skill about learning how to relax. They want the magic inside track of how it's going to do something special. That's where the hype comes in, and the marketing. All right. Speaking of challenging established beliefs, Evan, mm-hmm. you're going to now. Debunk for us Columbus Day. You have to be careful. Be careful, Evan. You're on this show with three paisanos.
So right. Thank you for reminding me. That's always an important reminder. This past Monday, that was Monday, October 9th, it was Columbus Day. Columbus Day is a national holiday in many countries of the Americas and elsewhere, which officially celebrates the anniversary of Christopher Columbus's arrival in the Americas on October 12, 1492. And it became a federal holiday in the United States as of 1937. So we've been observing it for many decades. Many Italian Americans, as you said, Steve, observe Columbus Day as a celebration of their heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And each year, the second Monday of October is the Columbus Day federal holiday. So it does fall on a different day each year numerically, but it's the second Monday of October. Oh, do you know what else October 9th was this year, Bob? National Nanotechnology Day.
Yay. That's no awesome, Bob.
How, cool wait, how did I miss that?
It was over in a hair of a second.
Yeah,
that's it was very short.
Wow. It was just for three nanoseconds, Bob.
Now, simultaneously, the second Monday of every October is Indigenous Peoples Day. And that's a holiday that obviously celebrates the Indigenous people of America. It is celebrated across the United States, mostly in cities and some states. They recognize it. It began as a counter celebration to the Columbus Day holiday. And it's intended to celebrate Native Americans and commemorate their shared history and culture. So, happy Columbus Day or happy Indigenous Peoples Day, whichever you choose to observe. However, Columbus Day and the man for whom the day is celebrated, Christopher Columbus, is not without controversy. It's all well and good to honor a person credited for discovering the Americas, but history suggests that Christopher Columbus was not all well and good. And these legends surrounding the man, if not outright myths behind the man, which children in the United States for many decades have been taught from a very early age. Well, I think we can say with confidence that several of the facts about Christopher Columbus don't exactly jive with how he is taught in the elementary schools. For example, Here are a few common Christopher Columbus facts that have been, and in some cases continue to be, taught to kids. Number one, one of the main purposes of Christopher Columbus's 1492 expedition was to prove that the earth was round. Number two, Christopher Columbus discovered the American mainland. Number three, Queen Isabel of Spain sold the crown jewels to pay for Columbus's voyage. Number four, Columbus's ships were named the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. And number five, Columbus is revered, lauded, and admired for his exploratory skills, his savviness as a trader, and his temperance as a governor of many of the lands upon which Spain planted their flags, based on his discoveries. When examining history, and I'm speaking in sort of a general sense here, skepticism really becomes a very good tool to apply, because we have to remember that there are certain biases in play, especially from the point of view of those who are still around to either write or record or retell or teach the events which eventually become history, history with a large capital H. There's an old saying that history is written by the victors, and I think there's some truth to that, especially when it comes to the recounting of major battles and wars throughout history. And we've also spoken about this before on previous episodes of The Skeptic's Guide, where history could be written quite differently from those who wind up on, say, the losing side of these conflicts. And we've talked about it sometimes in the context of science fiction, where, say, in Star Wars, the people fighting on the side of the Galactic Empire see history play out very differently than that for which we're treated to in the movies, where with a small band of rebels and a few remaining Jedi Knights. So it's always good to keep that in mind. But when we're teaching history to the still developing brains of 6 and 7 year old children who at that age start to learn about Christopher Columbus in American classrooms, they get sort of a watered down, simplistic version of history that has a way of obscuring.
It's not just watered down. It's factually incorrect.
Well, a lot of it is. I mean, there are some things, because I went online, Steve, and looked at sort of these online guides and things that they give for teachers and what to show in their classes. So I would say, perhaps some time ago, yes, we were getting totally, you know, the wrong stories about Christopher Columbus, but they seem to have started to make some corrections.
Yeah,
some
it's definitely things. Better
so that's
now.
Good. Yeah. It's better now. But yes, for us who are adults now, what we were taught in our school age, you really have to kind of throw out those books. And I brought up five specific ones. So let me touch on each of these real quick. Number one, one of the main purposes of Christopher Columbus's 1492 expedition was to prove the earth was round. That's not true. It was well established by certainly the 1490s and well
by the
before
ancient
that,
Greeks.
Yes. So what, 1,000 years prior?
Yeah, pretty clearly.
Eratosthenes.
Yeah, the ancient Greeks figured out that the earth was a sphere, and that knowledge was never lost. That scholars knew that from the time of ancient Greeks. No scholar in the Middle Ages believed that the world was flat. So yeah, that was just a retrofitted much later myth.
They say that that particular myth was came back sort of into the consciousness of the public thanks to American author Washington Irving's 1828 chronicle of the life and voyages of Christopher Columbus.
Yeah, that's part of it.
Brings that up, right? And I'm sure there are other examples. Really, what was in question at the time was the Earth's circumference. How big was the Earth? And that was a big, you know, there was still debate as to how large the Earth was at its equator, for example. Upon mapping his route, Columbus underestimated the distance to Asia, which was his destination, by huge, about thousands of miles.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he just made poor calculations, and therefore, you know, the myth about him trying to prove that the world was not flat, absolutely wrong. Number two.
Not only did he grossly underestimate the size of the earth, but he also rejected the consensus opinion of the experts of the time. So he was a crank.
Yeah.
He was substituting his own bad math for the people who had more expertise than he did, who were like, nah, who got the size of the earth almost exactly right. Again, right. Eratosthenes knew it was basically had the right answer.
Amazing
and
accuracy.
If the Americas weren't in the middle, you know, of his journey, he would have starved in the middle of the ocean like everyone said he was going to.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely right. He also had the concept of an earth being more sort of pear-shaped rather than actually spherical in nature.
Right.
I don't know if he was taking into account perhaps something about the equatorial bulge, which we know is a thing, but I kind of doubt that It was
the Earth is a little pear-shaped.
Yeah.
But slightly. Not in the way that he thought. Yeah. It bulges a tiny bit at the southern hemisphere versus the northern hemisphere. But yep. It's more correct. It's a sphere to first approximation, right? That's these are subtle tweaks that we've been able to understand through like satellite measurements, et cetera. But mm-hmm. yeah, a workable model of the Earth is basically a sphere.
I don't know if you were taught this in school, that Christopher Columbus discovered the American mainland, but if you were, that's wrong. He never set foot in the North American mainland.
Not in North America, South America, and Central America, yes.
Right, Central America, yes. But North America, no. No, he wasn't even the first European to come to the Americas. Many historians suspect that Viking Leif Erikson, whom I think we know about. Oh, by the way, October 9th is recognized each year as Leif Erikson Day. So it just happens to be coincidence that
it's pronounced Leif?
Columbus Day. Leif Erikson? I pronounce it Leif, but I don't mind being corrected on that.
Yeah, the difference between Leif Erikson and Columbus, though, is that when Columbus discovered the Americas for Europeans, we have to say, because there were already a million people living here when he got here. So he didn't discover it for humans. He discovered it for Europe. But when he did, it didn't ever have to be rediscovered later by anyone else.
That's right.
Whereas when Leif Erikson did, that knowledge was lost. So he didn't really definitively discover it for Europeans.
No, he didn't. And the fair point, because also there's suggestions that the Chinese actually made it to the west coast of America in the early 15th century.
That's never been proven, though, right?
Not proven, no. Yeah. But suggestions, and there are people who do have some, you know, are suggesting that that did happen. And also, frankly, I think, you know, again, going back to the indigenous people, what about the people who crossed the Bering Straits 13 or 14,000 years, you know, prior? I mean,
Clovis.
You know, where do they fit into all of this? So perspective has a lot to do with this, and that gets glossed over, certainly perhaps not even brought up in the classrooms. And that's worthy of correction. Something I learned as a child, but here's a correction. Queen Isabel of Spain sold the crown jewels to pay for Columbus's voyage. Nope. She did not. He was turned down for this voyage by three other crowns, Portugal, France, and England. Spain happened to be the fourth one, and they did fund his journey, but they put up very little money, actually, from the Spanish treasury. And no, Queen Isabella did not have to sell her jewels. Now, here's one.
They also said no initially, and then later rechanged their mind and said yes.
Yeah, I guess he hired a good lobbyist after a while, realizing, like, I think I need some PR help on this one. Columbus's ship were named the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, right?
That's what we always hear.
Yeah, that's what we hear. The original names were La Santa Clara, La Pinta, and La Santa Gallega. G-A-L-L-E-G-A.
What? How did that happen?
Well, here we go. It was common at the time for crews to give ships nicknames. And there are the nicknames of the ships are Nina, Pinta, Santa Maria. La Santa Clara became La Nina, the girl. La Pinta became La Pintada, the painted one, or in other words, the prostitute. And La Santa Gallega became Maria Galante, the name of another prostitute. The church censored the names, but we remember them, you know, because of the crew's vernacular. So the church had something to do with interfering with the actual names of the ships. And then finally, and certainly the most controversial part, is that Columbus, being sort of revered and lauded and admired for his exploratory skills, savviness as a trader, temperance as a governor, that does not jive. Many historians argue that Columbus was not a great explorer. His successes that he did have were accidents. He grossly miscalculated the size of the earth. He failed to set his feet upon India or East Asia, for that matter. He was not a great businessman, nor was he a savvy trader. He became a slave trader, in a sense, and an unscrupulous businessman, taking advantage of native populations on the islands and the mainland shores of Central America. And as far as being the governor of these locations, there were many more failures than successes. For some of the colonies that he initially founded, he had left, and then by the time he returned, the whole colonies were dead for, you know, various reasons. So they did not prosper. Whoa. He did not have things in control to leave good existing colonies behind.
He was eventually taken back to Spain in chains, arrested, yes, and put in jail for mismanaging his lands.
Yep, that's right. For mismanaging land and not treating, mistreating of the people. There was lots of cases of malnourishment, overwork, disease that got spread, which I don't directly hold Columbus per se accountable for. He wasn't looking to spread disease. It just happened to be a fact that Europeans were immune to, had stronger immune systems. And when you start bringing your cattle and your livestock over, you're going to bring it to these people who have no protection, no immune protection against these things. And it's going to really, really decimate the populations.
Well, they had, they had acclimated immune systems. They just, not that they were objectively right. better. They were just, these were the bugs that their immune systems were already adapted to. And
that's right, because whole populations, throngs of people were died in Europe on the way to, getting to the point where you had people with immune systems that were robust enough to handle some of this stuff.
Yeah.
He had a tyrant streak to him, Columbus did. He cut off hands and limbs and tongues of people for speaking out against him. And it wasn't just to the natives to whom he's treated poorly, which we, a lot of people feel is the most controversial part of him. He did it to the settlers, the Europeans who also came over for these at these colonies. He had very heavy-handed tactics. And like you said, Steve, he was recalled because of the mismanagement, mistreatment, and really bad governorship that he was.
Yeah.
He was a terrible governor.
So what's interesting about the Columbus controversy is that historians don't disagree about any of the facts, right? We have, for example, his ship's log, right? His diary, right. Essentially. So we have lots of historical records of what actually happened. So there is a lot of controversy about the basic facts. We know that Columbus thought he was going to India and China, and he landed in this undiscovered country. So essentially he was a crank who got lucky, basically, and should have been dead by all rights. We know that he thought that the natives were his to use as he saw fit. He captured them in slavery. He treated them brutally. He basically thought, oh, these are lovely people. They'll make nice servants, he says, like in his diary.
The friendly, good people. That
they'll make wonderful servants. And if they get out of line, I'll just cut their hands off and show them, so that's not controversial. We know that happened as well. We know that, he ended up failing as a governor and was, arrested and brought back to Spain in chains. He then got out of prison and returned to the New World another time. We also know, though, that Columbus's, by doing what he did because of him, and his voyages, he did open up a trade between the East and the West. He did open up trade between Europe and the New World. And that was enduring. For good or for bad, all the effects that happened from that, that is also pretty much an uncontroversial fact as well. What is controversial is how you interpret all of those things, right? And that's subjective, to an extent. So clearly what Columbus did was awful and terrible and evil by modern standards.
Right.
And you could probably also say by the standards of the day, he was a brutal guy. But it was accepted by the standards of the day. Slavery was accepted. There was a burgeoning slave trade. And he's like, oh, look at this, all these new slaves, So, it's easy to sit in the 21st century and be judgmental of somebody in the 15th century who had the morals and ethics of people in the 15th century. You know what I mean? So our views of him need to be tempered to some extent, because of that. It doesn't mean that what he did wasn't bad. Doesn't mean that he wasn't a bad guy, even by the standards of his own time. But he was a product of his time, and like we all are. So we don't take so much credit for just being a product of your time. I mean? Mm-hmm. Where do things come in on balance? Is he a symbol of European oppression and villainy against the New World? Is he a hero for being an explorer and opening up trade between Europe and the New World? Is he both of those things at the same time? I think that I tend to approach these things that, people are complicated. People are good and bad. And you have to it is what it is. He did what he did and it was complicated. But we certainly don't want to whitewash it and make him into this cartoon hero that he wasn't.
Sure.
But we also don't. I don't think we want to go too far the other way and just paint him as a cartoon villain either, He was a complicated man who did some really horrible things, you know, but also was, I think, courageous and ambitious, and as a result, changed the world. That is undeniable as well. So if we're in these kind of situations, it's important to see somebody in all their complexity and not any kind of cartoony version one way or the other.
I agree.
I do agree, however, though, that means not celebrating him as a hero only, right? And that's, I think, the real problem with Columbus Day, where it's just like, let's celebrate this guy as an explorer. Let's forget about all the other stuff that he did, you know, the whole slavery.
Yeah.
Bit. Yeah.
That smacks of revisionist history, and that's really, really bad.
And I know it kind of ruins a lot of the things, you know what I mean? Because a lot of our culture is based upon just revering heroes. But then we learn like, okay, but history is more complicated than that. But I think that's just, we just have to get over that. And we're going to take a more mature view of our own history. And that means all of our heroes are going to be tainted. Right. Every single one. Because they were all people, and they all were products of their time, and they all had flaws, and they all did some bad stuff. And that's just the way it is. And I think we just need to remember them that way. And then also, you know, I do think it's really good to celebrate Native Americans as well, you know, and having the, you know, combining it with sort of an Indigenous People's Day and saying this is all part of this history is, I think, the good approach.
I definitely agree with that.
All right, Bob, I understand we found half the missing matter in the universe.
So, yeah, so there's a lot of shit missing in the universe, and we found some of it. So that was my first opener. The second one, upon further reflection, I said, maybe I should just say this. Two separate groups of geeky astronomers claim to have found the missing baryonic matter in the universe. So now I'm not talking about dark energy or dark matter, which means, yes, there's another type of matter that's missing in the universe, and it's regular matter. This is the stuff that emits light, or at the very least it blocks light. Baryonic matter, and it's a good chunk of it's missing.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but at this point, when I think of that missing matter, I think of matter and antimatter from the Big Bang.
No.
And how it was. Are we talking about this? Like,
no.
We think that there more matter survived the matter-antimatter?
No, this is not. This is not antimatter. Okay. This is not dark matter. This is just regular stuff.
This is regular. Baryons are pretty much everything that you deal with every day. Protons and neutrons. Or more fundamentally, it's three quark composite particles. Protons have three quarks. Neutrons have three quarks. All elements are made up of these. So the visible universe is baryonic matter. And this, of course, ignores particles like electrons, which are not baryons, but they are leptons. But that's just an aside. So this is all just about 4.6% of the universe. The rest is dark matter and dark energy, but it doesn't matter. It's still a beautiful, visible universe. So say it with me. This is my visible universe. There are many like it, but this one is mine. No? All right, maybe later. Maybe we'll do it later. So theories tell us how much of this baryonic matter there should be, and we couldn't find it. It's like, where is this stuff? 50 to 90% was missing, depending how you look at it. I think if you include all baryonic matter, including black holes, which might not be a great idea, it's 90%. But if you don't include those, it's like if you include halos, it's down to 50%. So it's still a huge chunk of the visible universe we cannot find. Even after you add up every star, every galaxy, every meatball, it just did not add up. We could not find it. So, but there was hope. Simulations have been telling us for decades that this missing matter can be found in these tenuous filaments that connect galaxies together. But the weird thing is that almost didn't even matter, though, because we still couldn't find it. It was just so, you know, cold matter like that just won't emit any radiation that any telescopes that we know can detect. You may be thinking, why does finding it matter so much? Well, first off, hello, science. That's your first reaction. The second one is that, you know, if it's truly there or not there, or if it's there but bigger than we think or smaller than we think, that's still very, very important because that means that our theories are wrong. It means that our simulations have gotten something wrong. And then, you know, that means we need to fix this stuff if we're ever going to simulate and understand the universe more fully. Plus, you know, an incomplete theory is a sad theory, right? You don't want to have a sad theory. You want to have happy theories. So this is the problem, and this is exactly what the two research teams seem to have solved. And they relied on science, of course. In this case, they relied on the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. This is a phenomenon that causes photons left over from the cosmic microwave background radiation to scatter into slightly different, slightly higher energies when they pass by electrons in the neighborhood. And in this case, those electrons were in the faint gas connecting the galaxies. So I find it very ironic and pleasing that the leptons are instrumental in helping us find the missing baryons, which is kind of interesting. So, but that's not even the clever stuff. That's not even the clever bit. The clever bit, though, was how they actually saw this signal. They took thousands upon thousands upon thousands. I think one team took 1 million images of galaxy pairs and they stacked them up. They put one on top of the other. You know, they scaled them and sized them so they kind of were oriented properly. And they stacked them up one on top of the other, on top of the other. And each image that is added to that stack amplifies the signal a little bit, a skosh, tiny, tiny amount. But when you're dealing with so many images, that tiny, tiny amplification builds up and builds up. And eventually they were able to detect the faint effect on the filaments caused by the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. So both teams then claim that they found a density of baryonic matter above the background, above what you would find in in extragalactic space. Now that density is only 3 to 6 times more dense. So think about that. You know, you're looking at the space in between galaxies, and which is pretty rarefied, right? I mean, what is it like? One particle per cubic centimeter? I mean, it's like better than the best vacuum that we could create on Earth. I think it's even less dense than that. So what they found was only 3 to 6 times more dense than that, you know, which is still not dense at all, but it's detectable if you use this method. And everything that they found matches our theories as predicted. So there's no huge anomalies in our theories. And that's good. And maybe in some ways it's bad because there's no new physics, you know, that we're going to find with this specific thing. But
I mean, occasionally we have to find that we were right. You know what I mean? Everything can't be turning what we thought we knew upside down.
Right. And this is large scale stuff. This is, you know, the cosmos. This is astrophysics. We're not talking particles or quantum mechanics or anything like that. So, yeah. So it makes sense that, you know, the big picture, our big picture theories are correct. And they are, which is fantastic. And I love the fact that there's two separate teams that came to very similar conclusions, which of course always strengthens the theory, because that's one of the hallmarks of science is replication. So it's already been replicated in a sense.
At least we found all the regular matter, you know. Yeah, I think it's interesting. Most people didn't even realize that we were missing half of it, you know. But
right.
we weren't really, we kind of knew it was there. It had to be there. It all made sense. We really just needed to figure out a way to see it. And that's what they did. And it matched what we knew we were going to see. Yeah.
Right. And it's interesting because the dark matter, you know, we see the effect of dark matter. We just don't know what the hell it is. The baryonic matter, we know what it was. We just couldn't quite see it. So, kind of an interesting difference.
Well, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Last week, I played this noisy. What is it?
Ooh.
Something electronic.
Something computer related. Bob, any other very generic?
A dictaphone. Yes.
So first I will say that nobody got it, and I really thought that I was going to get a wash with people guessing this correctly, because I gave a very strong clue. I'll tell you some of the things that people thought it was. I had a listener named Austin who wrote in and said, I thoroughly enjoy the show. And that noisy sounded a lot like what would happen if you used an auto-tune processor to measure and alter the pitch of wind howling.
Whoa.
Sounds like a lot like Kanye West. That's not correct, but I thought that was funny.
It's a very specific wrong answer.
Yes. I got a couple of other guesses here. One person said, this is Jim Kelly, he said it's the sound of DNA converted into a waveform on an Atari 800 with the expanded 48K of RAM. Close, but not even close. So again, no winner this week, guys, but what the heck is it? That is an audio-visual rendering. So because there is a you could see a video of this as well, but the audio is much more interesting. It's an audio-visual rendering of liquid water. And the sound relates to the interaction of the tagged water molecule, because there's one more water molecule that we're following, and it's colored blue in a field of red. And it's essentially its interaction with all the other water molecules.
Hmm.
So every time you hear a tone, it corresponds to water on water interaction, you know, between the energy between the molecules.
Cool.
Very cool.
Now, I have a new noisy this week, and this new noisy is, again, some of you might find it to be very familiar. I want some specifics on what it is, but just take a listen to this. And by the way, this was sent in by Julian Goodwin. Thank you, Julian.
No light speed.
Heaven. Apparently that sound effect was taken by something in the real world. And that's my only clue that you're going to get on this week's Who's That Noisy. So if you think you know what it is, or if you heard anything that's really cool that you think I might want to use on the show, you can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Cool. We have one email this week, but before we get to that, we have a couple of announcements. Jay already mentioned that Jay Bob and I are doing a Alpha Quadrant 6, which is a Star Trek Discovery After Review show. So go to our Facebook page. It's simply Facebook/Alpha Quadrant 6. You'll see our previous three episodes. The new ones drop at 9:30 right after Discovery. Discovery drops at 8:30 on Sunday night. And we watch it. And then we do the review show starting at 9:30. Also, so in 2 weeks, we are going to be at SciCon.
Las Vegas.
Las Vegas, yep. So October 26th to 29th, SciCon Las Vegas. I'm sure you could still get tickets and go if you haven't booked it yet. It's going to be a great conference, lots of great speakers. But this announcement is to let you know that we will be doing a private recording. So if you are going to be there, or if you're just going to be in Las Vegas, you can come to our private recording on Friday, October 27th, beginning at 10 p.m. The exact location will be announced on site. If you want to attend that show, it's $75 per ticket. There's limited seating, so and we do tend to sell these things out. Email us with the subject line "Private SciCon." You can pay us by going to our website and going through PayPal. We need your name and some contact information so that we can text you or call you in order to tell you the location of the recording. So that's just in 2 weeks, October 27th, again at 10 p.m. And Jay, you got another announcement as well.
So yeah, any listeners out there that can help the SGU, we are looking for a software development company who can fully manage our web properties. And this includes several WordPress sites, blogs. We have custom software. We have, you know, hosting needs. Overall, we want someone that can do everything for us. And of course, we're willing to pay for these services. And we want someone that's f-ing awesome.
So right now the company we're using to host and manage our websites can't handle the amount of work that we have for them. We're outgrowing them. And so we're looking to migrate over to a company that could manage all of our online websites.
We have formally outgrown our previous company and are looking for a new partner. So if you're interested, want more information, or would like to talk to us about this, you can email us at info@theskepticsguide.org and put the subject software development company in the header so we know what this is about.
All right. So we got one email. This one comes from, I believe the name is pronounced Teague, T-I-G-H-E. What do you think? From
okay.
Los Angeles.
I'll go with that.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And he writes, hi guys, I have a random question I'm hoping you can help me with. I have an insulated steel thermos made by Yeti. Best insulated cup I've ever used, hands down. I have no affiliation with them, FYI. If I put hot coffee in it, no warmth registers on the outside. The cup's insulating design is working as intended. The temperature delta here is roughly 80 degrees, 150 degrees coffee. 70 degrees ambient temperature. That's obviously Fahrenheit. That's pretty impressive in my book. But if I put an iced drink in, the outside of the cup becomes pretty cool pretty quickly. It still keeps the drink pretty cold, but I'm confused as to why it does not seem to be insulating as well. Here, the temperature delta is only about 40 degrees, 70 ambient, 30 drink. So it seems to be insulating much better with a warm liquid, but I just can't make sense of this. I don't see why it would matter. Energy is energy after all, I would think. It's the temperature delta that matters more. Thoughts? My only guess is that the solid ice contacting the cup's inner wall is cooling it down more than expected. Thanks, guys. Love the show, by the way. Keep up the good work. Very interesting question. We love these nerdy physics questions. I don't know that we have a definitive answer to this question.
Nope.
Because
I don't.
But we can start by talking a little bit about the physics of thermoses. So this all has to do, of course, with heat transfer. How does heat get from one place to another? There's basically three mechanisms. One mechanism is conduction. Heat physically moves through a substance. That's conduction. You know, different substances conduct heat to different degrees. Then there's convection. Convection is when a liquid, like a liquid or a gas, something that flows, physically moves, right? So the hotter stuff is physically moving, flowing, you know, through the substance to somewhere else. And then the third one is radiation, which is a hot object will radiate away energy in electromagnetic waves, right, as electromagnetic energy. So radiation, convection, conduction. Those are the three ways.
But for heat, it's infrared. We're talking infrared.
Well, it depends on how hot, what the temperature is, right, of the body. You know, if it's millions of degrees, it probably is not infrared, right?
Yeah, but what we would call heat would be infrared.
Yes. Yeah. For if you're talking about your coffee, then yeah. So yeah. So a thermos, if you have what's called a vacuum insulated thermos, which is the most common type, and those are the ones that really work. So essentially, you have an inner cavity that holds the liquid, and then that is surrounded by a vacuum chamber, except for like the very top where it connects to the outside. And then there's usually a gasket at the bottom to hold it into place. But everywhere else, it's surrounded by vacuum. And then there's the outer container, right? So of course, a vacuum doesn't allow for any convection because there's nothing to move. And it doesn't conduct very well at all. It doesn't conduct at all either. So the conduction is only going to be going through the points that are actually touching to the outside. It still allows for radiation, however. So they also, you know, a good thermos will also have a silvered inner chamber so that it reflects the radiation back into the liquid. So it's preventing all three forms of heat transfer, radiation, convection, and conduction. It's minimizing those three. And so if something is, you know, if you put hot coffee in there, obviously it's going to keep that heat in very, very well. It's the rate of heat loss to the environment is going to be extremely slow, and so it'll stay hot for a long time. Cold, it's the same thing. So the question is, why would there be an asymmetry between a hot substance and a cold substance? And I couldn't find a definitive authoritative answer online. I did find facts that may help us think about what the answer might be, but I couldn't find anything definitive. So it's possible that this is something quirky, unique to Teague and not a general phenomenon. So we would need to explore that further. So it should be fairly symmetrical. What I did find was the opposite of what he experiences. There were lots of people who were explaining why a thermos may work better with cold than with hot. And that is what Teague zeroed in on, that's the temperature differential, right? Because the greater the differential, the more heat will transfer. So if you have something that is 70 degrees or 80 degrees warmer than the ambient temperature, that should cool down faster than something which is only 20 or 30 degrees cooler than the ambient temperature will heat up, right? But that's the opposite of what Teague is saying. So I do have one hypothesis. Well, other than that Teague is just crazy and wrong, but assuming that his subjective
That was my hypothesis.
That was it. Yeah, you were going with that one. But let's assume that his subjective report is accurate. My hypothesis is that his thermos is broken. The extreme temperatures can change, you know, because of the thermal expansion effect, right? So maybe when the inner chamber is contracting, when you put something that's really, really cold in there, it's losing its seal in some way, and then that's causing the vacuum to fail, or it's causing some of the fluid to leak out into the outer chamber. I don't know, but that's not with heat, that right. So when things are cold, it contracts and that can open up openings. When it gets hot, it expands and that could seal openings. So maybe with hot things, it's sealing better than with cold things.
Yeah. But it's probably not a vacuum breach, because once it's breached, I mean, that's it. It's gone.
Yeah, right. Or if it were, it wouldn't be working as well as he says it's working.
Right.
But the only other thing I could think of is that, even though, as he says, heat is heat, but then the temperature differential should really be the only thing that matters. However, there may be an asymmetry in the direction that heat travels. So, right, because when you have a hot substance, you're keeping heat in. When you have a cold substance, you're keeping heat out. So maybe heat can get into the thermos better than it can get out of the thermos.
That's interesting.
So I'm just trying to think just conceptually that's an asymmetry. And so maybe the radiation is maybe where it's different. Maybe it reflects radiation back in better than it reflects radiation out. Conduction and convection should be the same in either direction, right? So those are my two hypotheses, the thermos is literally functioning better because the heat expansion is sealing it better, or there's an asymmetry in the way it's blocking radiation from one direction versus the other direction.
We may need to consider another option, and that would be a coding problem in the simulated universe that we're living in. Granted, low probability, but we can't ignore that.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, it's an anomaly in the coding program of the Matrix. Yeah, that's possible.
It's a way to break out.
Way to think outside the box, Bob.
Yeah, totally.
But it's an interesting little mystery to try to think about what could be a possible answer and to understand how thermoses work, you know. All right, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious.
I knew you were going to say that.
You did?
You should have talked.
I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake-a-rooney. Do you know why I was going to say that?
Yep, the fake-a-rooney, definitely.
Yeah. Fake-a-rooney, yep.
I have to come up with new euphemisms for fake. And this week, I have a theme. You're going to like this theme. So a whole bunch of battery-related news items dropped today.
Oh, boy.
Oh, here we go.
Oh, boy.
So I was just flooding my science news, site. So I'm like, all right, whatever. Here they are. Let's go through a bunch of battery. I know we talk a lot about battery tech and there's a lot of news items, but there was just too many of them for me to ignore. So here are three battery-related news items. Are you ready?
Positively.
Okay. Here we go. All right, here we go. Item number one. Engineers have built a usable nano battery using waste graphite that has sufficient energy density to run a pacemaker for 20 years. Item number two. Researchers have developed an air-breathing flow battery usable for grid storage that costs 20% as much as lithium-ion batteries with nearly as much energy density. And item number three, a new analysis finds that there are enough raw materials available to meet projected demand for lithium-ion battery production for at least 15 years. Evan, you get the wise-ass reward of going first.
Because I said positively?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm not trying to discourage you from being funny, but your head popped up. It's going to get chopped off.
I guess it did. All right. The first one. Engineers have built a usable nanobattery using waste graphite that has sufficient energy density to run a pacemaker for 20 years. Well, do you need how much? I guess the question is, and I wish I knew this, how much energy is required to operate a pacemaker and for how long? That would help me a lot, but I don't have that information. Maybe not, because how are you going to squeeze that much energy out of something so, so small like that? Size matters, I think. The second one, researchers have developed an air-breathing flow battery usable for grid storage that costs 20% as much as lithium-ion batteries, with nearly as much energy density. So one-fifth the cost, roughly the same energy density, and it's an air-breathing flow battery usable for grid storage. Grid storage. Okay, I think this one's going to be right. This is very good news. I mean, you know, 20% the price. Nothing wrong with that. And air-breathing flow battery, I don't think that's a problem. I don't see anything wrong there. I think it's very good news. And then the last one is the analysis that finds there are enough raw materials available to meet projected demand for lithium-ion battery production for at least 15 years. Well, was there a worry of a shortage of material for lithium-ion battery production? If there was, I didn't know about it. So this one makes it seem like this one's surprising that we have 15 years worth of raw materials. So I'll say this one sounds, I'm not detecting anything wrong with this one. The one I have the problem with, I guess, is the nano battery. Because, yeah, wow, the energy density problem there. I don't see the nano battery coming up with that much. It's not enough energy density there. Nope. I'll say nano battery is fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, let me just knock off the third one about the 15 years before we're in trouble with lithium ion batteries. Yeah, I mean, I've heard similar things about problems with supplies for a lithium ion battery. So yeah, that sounds about right. The other two are the ones that's kind of knocking me out here. The nano battery, I mean, I don't know. I don't think we've ever had a science or fiction item with the word nano in it that was false. So I'm not sure I should say this one was – I don't think I want to go against that.
Bob, that thought did actually cross my mind, believe it or not.
Second one's got a lot of things going against it in terms of being improbable. Air-breathing flow battery, what the hell is that? I'm not even sure what the hell that is. Sounds a little too convenient. Usable for grid storage. Grid storage, really? A battery for grid storage? Grid storage, 20% is lithium ion with nearly as much energy density. Oh, come on. That's just like holy grail of batteries. Cool, kind of. That's just like too good. That's just like way too many things. So screw it. The nano battery, you know, maybe, I don't know. Damn, 20 years. I mean, maybe it's more of a function of how little energy the pacemaker needs. You know, think about it. That's pretty tiny. Maybe it's doing some energy harvesting, but that wouldn't be fair if it was actually doing that. But, I mean, so yeah, I'm just not going to vote against nano. So I'll say that the number two there, the air-breathing flow battery, is fiction.
And Jay?
Yeah, the first one about the nano battery, it's, you know, I understand why Evan picked it because it sounds like, you know, 20 years is a long time. So I was under the impression that they recharged those batteries that they implanted in people that had have pacemakers. So this one would say, hey, we can run this thing for 20 years. Wow, that's amazing. And I'm not sure why you're calling it a nano battery, which is another...
Because it's very small?
I don't know. I don't know if the battery itself is small or the internal structure has some type of nano properties to it.
Yeah.
That's what I would think.
That's probably a good assumption.
My gut is telling me something strange about this. Like, is there like some way that it's collecting energy from the environment? I don't know. Maybe that's too futuristic. The second one here about the air-breathing flow battery usable for grid storage that costs 20% as much as lithium-ion batteries with nearly as much energy density. I don't like this one. I agree with Bob on this one. I would agree with the third one here that we're not able to meet the future demands of lithium ion battery production. That sounds somewhat familiar to me. So I'm going to go with the second one here as the fake, this one about the air breathing flow battery.
Okay, so you all agree with the third one, so we'll start there. A new analysis finds that there are enough raw materials available to meet projected demand for lithium-ion battery production for at least 15 years. You all think that one is science. By the way, what do you think are the needed raw materials?
Rare earth materials, right?
So for lithium-ion batteries, there are two that are the bottleneck. So if you, in other
lithium
words, there,
and,
there are
and ions.
Lithium and what's the other one?
Like platinum? Not platinum, but
no.
Oh, what the hell was it? That's the
cobalt. Lithium and cobalt.
Oh, is it cobalt? No.
This one is science. They said that, yeah, even with projected increases in demand for lithium-ion batteries, there's enough lithium and cobalt in order to meet that demand for that increased production. However, they said that this would require an increase in production mining infrastructure, and there could be bottlenecks. So we're not going to run out, but we may not increase the production fast enough to meet demand. It may become a limiting factor on manufacturing lithium-ion batteries if we don't keep ahead of the curve in terms of like building more mines, you know. But there's enough of it there. Beyond that, they didn't make any statements, but you know, eventually we could run into difficulty. You know, the ability to produce these things may be outstripped by demand. That's why, like, when people say, "Oh yeah, we're just going to have lithium-ion batteries be grid storage," like, really? You know how many batteries that would be? And you know, I think then that the analysis would totally change, right? If we're going to try to build lithium-ion grid storage batteries, then that's terawatts of storage that may then exceed the world supply of lithium and cobalt. Cobalt's interesting. Most of the cobalt that we get is mined along with nickel, and the nickel is what's paying for the mining. The cobalt is just sort of a side product.
Yeah, it's made of baryons, you know.
Yeah, they're all made of baryons. Yeah, we need to make a baryonic battery. You could market a baryonic battery, and it could just be like a regular, you know, EverReady or whatever, but it's, make it sound really cool, you know.
It would be cool.
Lepton transfer energy.
Ooh,
leptonic.
Leptonic transfer.
I'll pay triple for that.
All right, let's go back to number one. Engineers have built a usable nanobattery using waste graphite that has sufficient energy density to run a pacemaker for 20 years. Evan, you think this one is the fiction. Bob and Jay.
Yeah, maybe not anymore, though. But
hey, come on.
Bob and Jay, you think this one is science, and this
one
is the fiction.
You.
It is the fiction.
Good job, Evan.
But I still don't know how much energy it takes to run a pacemaker, though. So
I actually just threw in the word nano there for that exact reason, because I realized I've never had a nano fiction. I figured I would get some money on this.
You had the same.
Totally.
I hate you so much right now.
Oh, totally got us, Bob.
You totally got him on the pattern.
Son bitch.
All right, so this is based on a real news item, but very loosely. So what they did design a battery using waste graphite. So when you make steel, there's graphite as a waste product. So yeah, so it's called Kish graphite. It's basically just a waste product, you know, of steel production, but it has the physical characteristics that they want to exploit for this battery. Because it has the right sized flakes that will hold the electrons, you know, that hold the ions that they want. So they're basically flipping the lithium ion battery, instead of using the graphite at the cathode, they're going to use it at the anode. Yeah. So in a lithium ion battery, the electrons, the metal ions move back and forth between the cathode and the anode. But what they want, so again, this is a part of the same goal of designing batteries using cheaper, more abundant materials. Because, you know, lithium and cobalt, yeah, you know, while we might have enough for the next 15 years, if we increase production fast enough, that the supply lines of those materials are not going to be, they're expensive, and they may not always, you know, meet demand. So if you could make it out of something that's a lot more abundant and a lot cheaper, then, you know, that may make grid storage a viable option. So they're trying to use like the really, really common elements like magnesium and aluminum, right? Remember, aluminum is as common as dirt. If you could figure out how to make a battery out of that, that would be great. Sulfur is another one, you know, and waste products. So graphite's great material. So using natural graphite, it can work as well, But some forms of graphite are like in a fine powder, and that wouldn't work. You need the bigger flakes. But this Kish graphite would be, which is the waste product, would be perfect. So they were able to design a battery using this kind of system, using just the Kish graphite and cheaper materials, and they were able to get it to function. There, it's only producing. It has very low energy density. That's the potential deal killer here. It's like now we have all we have to do is get the energy density up to a usable amount, you know. But who knows if that will happen? This is one of those throwaway battery news items where, yeah, they figured out how to make a battery out of different materials, but again, unless it has all of those properties at the same time, it's never going to be ready for prime time. So I don't know if this is not one where I think necessarily we'll get anywhere. We'll see. You know, they have to get to characteristics that will be useful in some function. But, so that's why I just made it a fiction. So the running a pacemaker for 20 years. So right now, actually, existing pacemaker batteries last for an average of about 6 to 10 years. With 5 to 15 being the range. So 20 would be more than any existing pacemakers that are out there. However, with current technology, if you just made the battery bigger, you know, you could, you could make a pacemaker battery that could last 25 years. It's just bigger than, you know, we would want it to be. So making a smaller battery that could, you know, be the size of batteries that are currently used in pacemakers, but last even a little bit longer, like this would be a 25% longer or 33% longer, then that's significant. You know, going 20 years instead of 15 years, if you're 50 and you need a pacemaker, you'd probably want that freaking thing to last, you know, as long as possible. And they do have to basically remove it and swap it out when it gets to the end of its lifetime. So, you know, it'd be great if we can go to 40 years or 50 years and basically a lifetime, you know, so you would never have to remove the thing. That would be great. But this technology has nothing to do with the scale. This is more big, heavy batteries. This would be more, you know, the waste graphite one are not nano anything. They're not nano batteries. This is just, yeah, it's just for, there'd be more something that you would use for like a grid storage. Okay, all of this means that researchers have developed an air-breathing flow battery usable for grid storage that costs 20% as much as lithium-ion batteries with nearly as much energy density is very cool science. Again, you know, I looked very carefully to find, all right, what's the rub here? What's the deal killer? What's the thing they're glossing over? And I went to the, even to the original study, but then if, you know, it gets a little technical for me, admittedly, but so we'll see, you know, what, other people say about this over time, you know, when experts really start to rip it apart, but you know, the details all sound good so far. So again, they're trying to make an alternative to lithium-ion batteries using cheaper materials. In this one, they were trying to use sulfur. Now, sulfur is an interesting material because it's very energy dense. So sulfur could potentially be a good energy dense medium for batteries. The problem is that no one has been able to find a reversible reaction with sulfur, and therefore sulfur-based batteries would not be rechargeable, which means they would basically be worthless for most applications, right? They'd be okay for disposable batteries, but that's about it. So MIT researchers, somewhat by accident, hit upon a reversible reaction, though, that just involves oxidizing with air. Yeah, so that's why it's a flow battery, and it's an air breathing because that's part of the reaction. So oxygen flows into the cathode, causing the anode to discharge electrons to an external current. Oxygen flows out, sends electrons back to the anode, recharging the battery. So it doesn't produce any waste. There's no carbon dioxide or anything. And it just exhales oxygen, essentially. And it did produce a reversible reaction. They were able to do many, many, you know, charge and discharge cycles. They didn't say exactly how many, so maybe that's the rub. You know, we'll, again, every time they don't mention explicitly a detail, you have to wonder, was that going to be the limiting factor? But it should cost about $20 to $30 per kilowatt hour, where lithium-ion batteries cost about $100 per kilowatt hour. So it's about 20% of a lithium-ion battery, and it's made from cheaper materials. They said it has almost the energy density of lithium-ion. So if it's 20% as expensive and has 80-90% of the energy density, that's still a good exchange. You basically want to, like, how much is it going to cost per terawatt. You know, like if we're going to use this as grid storage, when we start to get to the terawatt scale, you know, how much is this costing per gigawatt of energy storage that it's going to have? We'll see. You know, these kind of batteries, you know, if you think if they're cheap enough, would it get to the point? And again, when we're starting to think about grid storage, I mean, this could be, imagine like if every house had one of these things buried next to it. You know what I mean? Like right now,
oh, man,
a lot
I
of houses.
That. That's what I'm waiting for.
Yeah. If you use oil heat, a lot of people have their oil tank buried in their yard. That's very common practice. You have this huge, big oil tank, you know, just buried next to your house.
Yeah. Good luck burying an oil tank these days, regulations.
Yeah, you can't do that anymore, but some older places still have them.
Yeah, that used to be the standard, you know. Yeah, I guess they just...
Too many environmental problems.
Yeah, they're worried about the oil leaking out or whatever. Mm-hmm. Seems like that could be dealt with just by regulating the tanks themselves. But in any case, you could have a battery either, whatever, in some kind of facility in your basement or in your garage or... You know, if it is environmentally safe to bury, just buried next to your garage or whatever. And then imagine if that could store, you know, a couple of weeks of energy, you know, for your house. And then you could use that in two ways, right? So one is if you had intermittent production, like let's say you have solar on your roof, obviously you could store the solar energy when you're making it and then you draw upon it when you need it. So it would make intermittent energy sources viable. Even if you didn't though, you could buy electricity off peak when it's really cheap and use it during the peak when the energy is more expensive, right? So you could use it for peak shaving, basically. And that would help you. And it would also help stabilize the energy grid because you're flattening out demand. So I wonder how many people would need to have a battery like that as part of their house in order to like really have a huge impact on the stability of the grid and flattening out the peak. The other thing is that with this battery is that it has a lot more energy density than pumped hydro, like 500 times the energy density of pumped hydro. You know,
damn,
it's 500 times less space than having a hydroelectric plant. But and it could actually compete with pumped hydro for cost effectiveness, for efficiency, and it's better in terms of space, and it also has no regional limitations. You could pretty much put them anywhere. You know what I mean? So it could be more versatile than pumped hydro. So this, you know, I do think it is very likely that if we can hit upon the right reaction, you know, the right battery technology where we could make big batteries cheaply, that could be the ultimate solution to grid storage and to, you know, really making the transition to intermittent renewable energy sources, you know? All right. So good job, Evan.
Well, thanks. Yeah. Surprise.
Yeah. But you got a quote for us?
This quote came courtesy of longtime SGU listener Richard Drum. Thanks, Richard. I like this quote.
Richard!
I'm not very optimistic about people's ability to change the way they think, but I am fairly optimistic about their ability to detect the mistakes of others. And that was written by Daniel Kahneman.
Yeah.
I'd like to borrow the words of Steven Pinker. I've called him the world's most influential living psychologist. I believe it's true. His central message could not be more important. Namely, that human reason left to its own devices is apt to engage in a number of fallacies and systematic errors. So if we want to make better decisions in our personal lives and as a society, we ought to be aware of these biases and see workarounds.
Yeah, really is the guy who developed the idea of heuristics, you know, these rules of thumb that we use and did a lot of seminal research in terms of these cognitive biases. Absolutely. We talk about his work all the time. Really incredible. Tried to get him on the show, actually, Daniel Kahneman. He would be fantastic, but he's basically retired and not doing it, and not doing that sort of stuff anymore. So
oh,
we just
bummer.
Caught him a little bit too late in his career, yeah. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure,
thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Oh, I want to say one other thing before I say next. Mm-hmm. I wanted to also point out, because people have asked us to do this in the past, next week we are going to review the movie Blade Runner 2049. So if you... want to watch the movie before our show drops next week, you'll be able to listen to the review, because otherwise, you know, our reviews are always full of spoilers galore. So heads up, we're going to be reviewing that the Blade Runner 2049 on next week's show. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org. where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.